Hello, welcome to Bare Naked Politics. I'm Julia Bell, and if you've been a subscriber for a while, you'll know that I just don't really like doing the kind of music and the jovial stuff at the top of episodes where I'm talking about topics that are frankly just horrible, such as war. In the last episode, I spoke to Dr. Trevor McCriskin, Reader of Politics and International Studies at the University of Warwick. And I mean, I put that episode out like a week ago, and at the time, Russian troops had gathered at multiple spots along their border with Ukraine. And we were kind of exploring the potential outcomes. Are we on the brink of an invasion? Is Putin just kind of peacocking? Is this all a bit of a ruse just to get the West to meet some of his demands? And then hopefully it'll all die down again, or perhaps somewhere in between. Maybe Putin's just looking to sort of occupy certain regions of Ukraine, such as the contested Donbass region in the east of the country, for example. Maybe he'll leave it there. We were looking at the different options. And then, my God, you know, in the space of literally a week, everything has changed and everything has escalated in such a horrific way, frankly, because in the early hours of February the 24th, Putin put out a pre-recorded televised broadcast announcing that he was launching a special military operation in Ukraine. And, well, within minutes, it was clear that, frankly, the whole country was under threat. Missile strikes, tanks, you know, armed personnel. And if you look at a map of the country, and I cannot keep stressing enough how I think it's really important to do that just so you get to grips with the geography of it all. But if you look at a map of the country and then you find out where explosions have been sighted so far, I'm recording this late in the evening on Friday the 25th. If you look at that map, it's so clear that, and by the way, Ukraine is a massive country, second biggest country in terms of landmass in Europe. Explosions are happening all over the place. This is not Russia just moving in on a subsection of the country, which was one of the options we explored. This is, as far as optics go, a full-scale invasion on a massive, you know, chunk of the continent. Especially because, of course, those military vehicles have moved in on the capital, Kiev, while the Ukrainian president is urging his people to form a resistance. Now, I'm absolutely sure that you don't need me to run you through the kind of countless reports of people fleeing, families splitting up, the footage as well of all those queues of traffic, of just people trying to leave the country. And whatever fuel they've got in the tank, that's going to have to just, hopefully it'll get us there. Let's get to Poland, Latvia, Lithuania. You know, it's really, if you try to put yourself in that frame of mind, it's terrifying. And, you know, all the photos of crowds of people kind of just sitting in subway stations and underground spaces. And it seems like the press, who, by the way, you can see they're all in their protection vests, the press, the military, they seem to be the only people that are actually out on the streets in many of these places, including in the capital, Kiev. You know, you look at the footage of the press talking to the cameras and they're the only ones there. So this is, without a doubt, a humanitarian crisis as well as a political one. And I think we can absolutely expect a massive influx of refugees, a wave of refugees, people, humans who are utterly displaced, at least for the time being, looking for somewhere to be safe, somewhere to eat, somewhere to be sheltered, somewhere to collect their family. Now, I know I'm kind of usually pretty irreverent about politics. That's kind of how I stop myself from feeling a bit depressed about some of it, as I just try to make light of a lot of it, but that's absolutely not responsible or doable for me to do today. And yet we are left with so many questions. Why are Russia doing this? How is Putin justifying these manoeuvres? Because literally days ago, he continued to swear that this build-up of troops on the border was just them conducting military drills, so-called military drills. So what's his line now? Now that this has absolutely happened, there's no denying it. What are you saying now? And also, what are the options of America, the UK, NATO, Germany? What are, you know, what are the Western allies going to do about this? What can they do about this? So Trevor very kindly took more time out to come back and talk to me. I'll jump straight into that for you. And I started off by simply asking, is it right, is it the right terminology to say that Russia are absolutely invading Ukraine? Is that the reality right now?
They are absolutely invading Ukraine from multiple directions. So, you know, we spoke, about a week ago, and at that point we weren't quite sure whether this was what Putin was planning, or if it was all, you know, kind of a way to coerce the West into, you know, giving some of his demands to him. But clearly, that was perhaps all smoke and mirrors, and that this was the intention, was to invade Ukraine, and that is what's been happening. So it is an invasion, and the, you know, the Russian forces that had been accumulated around Ukraine's borders have begun to move into the country. They've been using missile attacks. They've been using fighter bombers, helicopters, you know, armed helicopters, to attack targets in lots of different parts of Ukraine. And it appears today, where are we, Friday, about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, that ground forces are beginning to move on the capital, Kiev. They're also moving through the eastern regions of Ukraine, collectively known as the Donbass region, which is where the breakaway rebel republics that Putin first recognized a base, but they're trying to expand on the areas that are held by those breakaway republics.
Yeah, because I'm just trying to get a handle on the timelines here. Not long ago, maybe a day or two ago from when we're recording this, Putin officially recognized areas of Ukraine that are, by, you know, all international accounts, areas of Ukraine, but he recognized them as independent republics. Is that correct?
So on Monday of this week, he announced that Russia was going to formally recognize these two breakaway republics that are pro-Russian. Once he'd done that, he then ordered Russian troops and tanks into those regions by invitation, right. Supposedly.
By invitation, supposedly.
Yes. So he's the claim behind all of this invasion is that the reason for doing it is to defend those breakaway republics from Ukrainian attacks. He's also got other things that he's saying about, you know, the Ukrainian government, that it's a neo-Nazi government, that he feels that he needs to invade to free the Ukrainian people from this neo-Nazi rule. He's talking about this as a process of denazification of Ukraine, because this is obviously a Western-leaning government that is not, you know, that replaced a pro-Russian government back in 2014. And he's claiming it's just a puppet government of the West, and that it needs to be deposed, and that it's been trying to commit a genocide against the Russian-speaking peoples of Ukraine. You know, these are all positions that Putin has. They're not necessarily agreed by lots of other people who see things very differently. But that's the pretext for invasion.
And so if it's under the kind of guise, if you like, of a peacekeeping, freeing mission that he's doing from Nazification, like you say, if that's his angle on it, does that mean he hasn't officially declared war, or has he?
I don't 100% know the answer to that question. I mean, so formal declarations of war don't often happen in the modern era anyway.
Right.
The United States, for example, has not declared war on any other country since World War II. Even the Iraq War, Afghanistan War, these were not declared wars.
Okay.
But what, in the eyes of the Ukrainian government, in the eyes of most governments around the world, by moving Russian forces, ordering them into Ukraine and beginning to attack Ukrainian targets, it is an act of war.
Yeah.
So a war has begun, whether or not it's been formally declared or not.
Okay.
And so you know, there is a war going on in Ukraine now, and it's Russia has invaded Ukraine, and it's trying now to, you know, achieve whatever objectives it has. Those things I've just been talking about are the stated reasons that, or some of the stated reasons that Putin has given, but obviously they are completely rejected by the US, the UK, other NATO countries outside of NATO, who look at this, you know, and say that's just, a lot of that is just fantasy, and that actually this is all about trying to take control of Ukraine, to overthrow the Ukrainian government, to put in place a new government, which is going to be pro-Russian.
I was going to say, because I'm trying to wrap my head around, you know, when you think invasion, my brain gets split into, do you literally want to extend Russia and make out like Ukraine is just a big like bit of Russia now? Or do you want to maintain Ukraine's name and to some degree, I suppose, its cultural elements, but then pop in a puppet Russian supporting government? Those two things are quite different. But I take it from what you're saying, we don't really know what the plan is at this point.
No, I mean, it's, you know, that, and I'm sure I was guilty of this to some extent in the last podcast that we did. And, you know, I think whenever you try and do any kind of analysis of this sort, you try and put yourself into the position of the individuals making the choices and try to think, you know, what are they, what is it,
what are you really doing? Yeah,
it is difficult to know. I mean, it's impossible to know exactly what they're thinking, obviously, but it's difficult given some of the things he said are really contradictory to each other. And, you know, the way that they've started the invasion might suggest that they're going for complete control of the whole country, but maybe they're not. Maybe they'd be happy with certain areas of it. You know, there's different possible outcomes here. Initially, I think there were a lot of people that thought that if there was an invasion of any kind, it would have fairly limited objectives. But it does now look like they're also sending forces from the north down towards Kiev, which is the capital of Ukraine, and that you know, they want to take over, overthrow the government.
Well, this is it, because, you know, while we're talking, I got a BBC News update that said our latest maps show how Russian troops are pushing into Ukraine as invading forces reach the capital, so Kiev. And on social media, I'm watching, and I know you say you've got to be careful with what you see, but you can't mistake a video of watching tanks driving through kind of sort of suburban residential areas, literally a few kilometres away from the very capital where the government buildings are. And if I think tank, you know, if I'm like, I'm in West London now, if I saw tanks rolling past my house heading towards Parliament, there's only one thing I'd be thinking. It's not good.
Not good at all. I mean, the reports that I saw earlier today, and again, this is all from, you know, open sources, BBC, that sort of thing. It seems that those tanks that you mentioned were actually Ukrainian tanks that had been seized by Russian forces, and they were driving them into the northern suburb of Kiev under the Ukrainian flag, but it was actually Russians driving them. And that then the Ukrainian border patrol announced that this is what was happening and called upon citizens to try and stop them, to attack them using Molotov cocktails or whatever means they have. But yeah, so I guess what I'm saying is that it looks like Russian forces, advanced forces, or you know, whatever they turn out to be, are now breaking, you know, into the northern parts of the capital city.
Okay, in terms of how Ukraine are able to resist this, how plausible is that? I know we and the US and other kind of Western countries have been sending aid, military aid, but you were so emphatic, Trevor, in the last podcast that we are not, as it stands, sending our own troops. So British troops, for example, at this time are not going to be, you know, marching to Kiev to protect the Ukrainians. So how plausible is it that the Ukrainians can actually bat the Russians away at this point, basically on their own, right?
Yeah, so they are, and Zelensky said that this morning in his broadcast that that went out to the world, is we are in this fight on our own. And he understands, and it's very true, that the United States, the UK, other NATO members have categorically stated that they won't be sending troops into Ukraine to help the Ukrainians resist this attack. And I expect a lot of people are looking at that and thinking, well, that is just so wrong, because we've defended other countries around the world when they've been invaded, or we've gone and sent troops to, you know, places like Afghanistan, Iraq. Why aren't we doing it here? Because surely the Ukrainian people really need that protection. The difference is, of course, that it's Russia.
Yeah, I think everyone can kind of do the maths, right? Like, if we send in troops so that you've got British troops fighting Russian troops, that's World War III in the making. That's what's at risk, right?
And that's the problem here, is that, and it's awful, right? Don't get me wrong, it's absolutely awful, because in a sense, yeah, right on our doorstep in Europe, this major war is taking place. And you've got these 30 countries that are members of NATO, some of which border, four of them border Ukraine. And they're all saying, we can't send our troops in there to defend you. You've got to defend yourselves. We can supply you with military aid, but we cannot send our own forces in, because if we do, we are then fighting directly with Russia. Anyone who knows anything about their Cold War history knows that throughout the Cold War and that period after the Second World War, from, you know, 47 till about 89, 90, the United States and the Soviet Union, as it was then, were at loggerheads with each other through most of that period. But they tried incredibly hard for all of the kind of small wars and proxy wars and, you know, confrontations and what have you around the world. They did whatever they could to avoid fighting each other directly, because that then escalates into a much, much bigger conflict. And because both sides have got nuclear weapons, you know where that could end up, right? So, yeah. So that's the difference here. And that's the thing that Putin has known all along, is that it's highly unlikely, if not, actually they've said it's impossible, we're not going to do it, for the West to intervene, because then they would be at war with Russia. And he knows that they won't do that because they don't want to get into a big war, a world war with Russia, and they don't want to face a nuclear attack and those sorts of things. So that gives Russia a lot of freedom to do what they want here in Ukraine. The Ukrainians, however, so I think there might be different phases to this war. So we're right at the beginning. This is day two, right? And at the moment, the invading force seems to have a lot of advantages because they've got a huge amount of force that they haven't even sent in there yet. They've got, you know, the second biggest, second most powerful military in the world, according to a lot of the sort of analysis that goes on of who's got the biggest, you know, armies and material and everything else. So they're complete mismatch, right? Russia versus Ukraine is a
David and Goliath type of situation.
So the chances are that if the objective that Russia has is to knock out the Ukrainian government and to start to take over the country, I mean, they've said they don't want to occupy it, but do we believe anything Putin says now? Probably not. But he says that he's not interested in occupying Ukraine. He just wants to depose the government, denazification, and then the new government can rule over Ukraine. Well, maybe so, you know, but that he might do that. He might manage to achieve that with this invasion. But we've seen in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Vietnam, in so many examples where an external force comes in, tries to change the government of that country, that even if they manage to install a government, it doesn't end the conflict.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the Ukrainians, from what we're hearing so far, an awful lot of Ukrainians are saying, we will defend our country. We will stand up against these Russian invaders. We're not going to let them occupy us. You know, we saw off the Germans in the Second World War. All of these sorts of claims are being made. So even if Russia manages to win this war, this fight, and takes over control of Ukraine, deposes the government, that will not necessarily be the end of it. In fact, it's very unlikely that would be the end of it. You're likely then to have a long-term insurgent war.
Oh my God.
And you know, and the Russians have experience of this. They were in Afghanistan long before the Americans and the British were, you know, back in the 80s, having to deal with a similar situation where they invaded, they took over, but they just couldn't pacify the country. So we might, you know, the initial phase of the war might go on for quite some time. You would expect the Russians to be successful in that just because they have that much more, you know, material and military might. But then once they claim that they've won, it's kind of, you know, if you remember back in the Iraq war and Afghanistan as well, that, you know, the Americans say, well, we've won, you know, it's all over. But then an insurgent war goes on for years.
Yeah, it's not. And you've still got pockets. And those pockets change around, they change size, they regroup, they come back. It's just constant. For 20 years was what, yeah, Afghanistan. Okay, in terms of us, I've had lots of people on Instagram just messaging me questions, so I'll rattle through some if you're up for that. Louisa messaged saying, where can we go from here? After sanctions, which seems to be the big approach, I don't know how successful that's been. After sanctions, what next? Do we have other options?
Sanctions is the big thing that they're trying to do. So they're trying to impose as much economic and financial pain as possible on Russia, which is going to take time, you know, but over the course of time, it will affect the way in which Russia is able to continue with this particular conflict if this does go on for a long time. But what they're as much interested in is trying to ensure that they don't do anything else beyond this. And I think that's really where there was no red line drawn around Ukraine to say, if Russia invades or if they start bombing or whatever it is they start doing, we're going to intervene and stop them from doing that. But we do now have a solid red line down the border of Russia and actually the border of Ukraine now as well. NATO members, the 30 NATO countries in Europe, in Western Europe and Eastern Europe, and also Canada and the US, have within their treaty this Article 5, which says that they will, it's the collective defense clause, and it basically means if any one of those countries is attacked, it's considered an attack on all of them, and they will collectively respond against whoever it is that attacks them. So that's where we're at now. We're actually, you know, I think it's, I've resisted this notion over the last several years when people have said, oh, the Cold War's starting again. To all intents and purposes, it looks like we are about to enter a new phase of Cold War. That you've got the NATO countries, which include the Baltic states of Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, Poland, you know, all the way down the Russian border. And if any one of those countries is attacked, then all of NATO, that's when we get into, you know, that's where the dangers lie here, is that we could end up with a major war.
So our next steps, or
actually is to reinforce that. And it's quite ironic, because one of the things Putin wanted to get rid of was a stronger US presence in Europe and unity within NATO. Yet what we've seen over the last couple of days is probably more unity among NATO members and more sort of willingness to have the Americans come in and be part of that kind of protection of Europe than we've had for years.
Yeah, nothing unites anyone like a common enemy. And all Putin's doing is advertising how much of an enemy he potentially is about to be. So really the stuff we're doing now is the don't you dare stuff. Because it's a see if you step one toe over that red line, then all of NATO is going to come in full force to just squash you. So it's totally a war of words at this time as we watch on and don't help really outside of just offering military aid what's happening in Ukraine.
But of course it wouldn't be. If the toe comes over and we, as you said, squash them, they'll squash us. So that's why I think this notion that it almost feels like we've been dragged back, you know, 30 years, 40 years into a Cold War situation, because there are two, and this is where our international relations training comes in, Julia. there are two concepts that are really crucial here that are sort of old fashioned traditional concepts from the Cold War that a lot of analysts thought were just not that important anymore, that suddenly become crucially important. And we've got to hope that they hold true. Is this notion of collective defense, so everybody stays together, and the notion of nuclear deterrence.
Mutually assured destruction.
One of the reasons why, unfortunately, Putin and Russia have been able to do what they're doing now with Ukraine is partly because of the power of nuclear deterrence. So we, you know, the West knows, NATO knows that it cannot intervene in Ukraine without the possibility of that turning into a much wider war that ends up as a nuclear war. And surely nobody in their right minds wants a nuclear war because of the levels of destruction that come with that. So we're not willing to intervene to help the Ukrainians because that would put us up against Russia. So by the same token, we've got to hope that Putin understands that as well, recognizes that, and will do everything he can not to break through that border and attack a NATO country, because if he does, then we're back into this, you know. So he might think there are some of these states that maybe are weaker than others, and would the West really defend?
Like the Lithuanians and the Estonians.
Whatever. Yeah. And so collective defense has to remain solid.
So we have to, if he steps a toe over into Estonia, we have to put our money where our mouth is what you're saying, really, if we're going to stand by Article 5 of the NATO treaty.
Yeah. And I'm not saying that that would lead immediately to, you know, press the red button, because there would be escalation, hopefully, to get to that point if, you know, we could stop short of it. But if there was a conventional attack on one of those, any of the NATO states, we would use conventional arms to strike back. And then you have either it stops and both sides understand that, you know, they can't go any further because it's going to be too damaging to both of them, or it just gets out of control. And that's when, you know, we might lead to, heaven knows, let's hope not. But, you know, there's possibilities ahead of us here of a wider war. I would like to think, I really strongly believe that we wouldn't end up in that situation because we didn't during the Cold War.
So, you know how everyone says, like, it's so annoying how history keeps repeating itself. You're praying that history repeats itself.
Yeah, that little bit of it. It's not repeating itself as such. But the only thing the Cold War achieved was not to have a direct conflict between the East and the West, and it didn't go nuclear. But don't make the comparison completely, because we are in a very, very different world now than we were, you know, back in the time of the Cold War. And the interrelationships between countries is much closer as well, especially financially, economically, which again is why they're pressing on the economic sanctions, because the hope is that, you know, maybe there could be other powerful people in Russia who will say to Putin, look, enough is enough.
In terms of America, I remember when Barack Obama was president and they killed Osama bin Laden. And I know that Putin and Osama bin Laden are not one and the same in any way, shape or form. And Osama bin Laden was sort of hiding in a compound, and it was just a kind of quick nip this in the bud type of operation, whereas Putin is sitting atop an empire, if you will. Do you think, though, surely there will be some, there will be strategists in Washington going, how do we kill this guy?
There might well be some, but I would imagine they're all being told to shut up and go away, because that wouldn't solve anything, actually.
Would it not?
Not if the United States did it, because that would be an act of war. So there's the difference, you know. So Osama bin Laden obviously was the leader of a terrorist network, a non-state actor. And yes, he had allies around the world, but it wasn't the same as taking out the head of a foreign country. So much as that might sound like a way to resolve the issue. Yeah, I mean, if something happened to Putin that was not done from within Russia by Russians, I mean, you know, he might be deposed politically. There may be other ways that he ends up no longer being as powerful a person as he is in Russia. But if that's done from the outside, there will be enough people in Russia that will say, you did that to us, we're going to do that to you. And then we're in a war.
It just feels very singular. It feels very unilateral, like Putin is making these decisions and it's him. But you're basically saying, no, like, this is the Russian way. This is the Russian government. And if he were to go, someone would take that baton and move it forward, probably.
Yeah, no, I don't know if it's so much that. I mean, I think Putin as an individual does seem to have a really massive level of control over what happens politically, strategically, militarily, everything else in Russia at the moment. And there's a lot of fear that goes along with that. But a single individual doesn't have that all on their own, do they? They have people that are loyal to them. They have people that would stand up for them. I think what I'm saying more is that even those individuals that don't like their current leader, I think if their current leader was assassinated and it was proven to be anyone from the West, that would be seen as an attack on Russia and therefore, you know, an act of war. And that would not resolve the situation. It would just make it far, far worse. But and he might be removed from office from within, because, again, there have been, you know, coups within Russia, political machinations that lead to the leader being deposed. So there are different ways in which that could happen, and it might bring about a less war-minded president, and the policy could change greatly. And that's one of the calculations of the economic sanctions, is that the individuals that are being targeted are all incredibly influential, very well-off Russians, some of whom are extremely loyal to Putin, but some of them might be much more loyal to themselves or to their money or to, you know, their lifestyle or whatever.
loyal to the lifestyle. I love that. I want that on a mug.
They, you know, they could kind of band together to try to move against Putin politically within the country. That is a much better way for his reign to end, rather than it being imposed from the outside.
Okay. Kathleen wrote in saying, what do Russian people think? Obviously, there's these videos on social media of huge anti-war protests in Russia, but I'm trying to get a handle on to the kind of majority sentiment. Do people want this to happen? Are people indifferent? What do you think?
I think it's really difficult to know what public opinion really is in Russia, because it's not a democracy in the way that we are, you know, and it's not that there's very little free press. Free, you know, state TV is very influential. So it's really difficult to know exactly what the Russian people are thinking. Yes, there were protests yesterday on the streets. That is really significant, especially for it to happen on day one. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that's how, you know, the majority, a large number of Russians are feeling. It might just be those that come out on the streets. I mean, even in the West, we've seen really major protests against military interventions that the UK has been part of, or the US has been part of. Again, the Iraq war that we talked about earlier, massive demonstrations, possibly a million people in London protesting against that war before it started. Well, it still went ahead. It still went on for years. You know, the fact that a public is protesting on the streets won't necessarily stop a conflict before it starts, or even once it's going. But protesting in Russia is a very dangerous thing to do, because you could see a lot of those individuals were getting pulled off and arrested. We know what has happened to some of the opposition politicians, even, you know, punk bands that have kind of had songs objecting against the state have been gone after. So yeah, it's not a free state in the way that we would understand our country to be.
So Em on Instagram asked, what can we do to help?
I think engaging in this issue and not letting it go away. I mean, I don't think it will go away, but, you know, making sure that it is the forefront of people's minds, doing things like, you know, being on social media and responsibly saying things about it as well. I think, you know, not just kind of flippantly being angry about this, that, or the other, but actually trying to repost information that's useful, to ignore things that you don't think are quite right, or, you know, can't be verified. And just sending messages of support as well. I think that, you know, there will be, especially I think as the situation unfolds in Ukraine, if this goes on for a while, especially, there's going to be a lot of people displaced from their homes. A humanitarian, you know, consequences of this are likely to be very high. So making donations to legitimate sort of organizations that help refugees, that help send food to individuals that have been displaced, all of those sorts of things are the sorts of things that I think we can do in our everyday lives. I mean, this is really worrying, don't get me wrong, and I've had to talk to, you know, friends and family over the last couple of days who are really concerned about this, and I was feeling pretty despondent myself earlier in the week. But I think we need to try to be as positive as we can be in the face of this sort of aggression, because that is what it is, you know, and so trying to be supportive of positions get taken, you know, on our behalves, as it were, but also being a critical voice. And if we don't think either enough is being done or the right things are being done, to find ways of voicing those opinions as well, you know, whether that is through your social media contacts or from more traditional ways of kind of, you know, writing to your MP or, you know, going on marches, that sort of thing.
Just picking up on that comment you made about how, you know, you get asked about this. Of course you do, because this is your area. And so you're going to be the first person that people text to say, should I be scared? And Trevor, I want to ask you, are you scared?
I'm more scared now than I've been for quite a long time about the possibility of, yeah, world war and all of that sort of thing. One of the reasons I do what I do, actually, is because I was really terrified of the possibility of nuclear war when I was growing up. And so yeah, this is, you know, this is not good. This is a real step change in the way that nations are interacting with each other. I can see very dangerous situations possibly unfolding. And I've just got to have a bit of faith that, you know, calmer heads will prevail in the long run, that we will end up avoiding some really cataclysmic possibilities here. So it is scary in that respect. And I worry as well about, you know, friends and family who are considerably younger than I am, who have got much more time ahead of them to have to deal with the consequences of this sort of thing as well. And, you know, but it has been pretty difficult to deal with over the last couple of days. And there is that sense that we've been thrown back decades here. You know, this is the sort of thing that we used to have to worry about last century, really, more than this century. I know we obviously September 11th, 2001, the war on terror. It's not that it's been peaceful for the last 20 years, but the idea that we were going to have, you know, major war on the land of Europe between major powers is just, that is a real step backwards. And I think one of the things we talked about in the last podcast as well, you know, I was becoming more and more hopeful that we might be able to have some really transformative thinking around how governments deal with security, and to focus on, you know, not on these traditional security threats of countries amassing weapons against each other, but actually to move beyond that and to start focusing on the environment and poverty and disease and all of these things that threaten every single person on the planet.
And then
this happens and it's like, oh no, you know, that means now that all the resource and the attention is going to be put into trying to prevent more of this kind of conflict taking place. And sadly, I think that's going to be at the expense of much more progressive thinking, transformative thinking around how we make the world a better place. Maybe not, you know, I mean, it might be the final hurrah of that old way of doing things and we end up with positive consequences as a result, but it feels really, you know, quite dark, doesn't it? I don't want to end the podcast like that, really, but...
No, I think it's really responsible to do that, Trevor. I think you're right that not only is this kind of devastating and you can't help but start to catastrophize some potential outcomes, you can't help it, but also, like you say, it's a total distraction from the stuff that really, you know, you're talking about worrying for future generations. This is a really sad day for them. And, you know, it's interesting to think about, like, climate scientists will be watching this and putting their head in their hands going, oh my God, any forum I might have had is gone now for a while. Will you be around in a week or 2 weeks, or, you know, this thing's constantly developing?
Let's see what happens, eh?
Can you put me on speed dial? Can I put you on speed dial?
Yeah, I like coming on and doing this. It's good. It's good.
Dr. Trevor McCriskin there, such a helpful, clear insight as far as he can as to what is going on. Thank you for taking the time out. And, you know, he really is an inspirational lecturer and reader at the University of Warwick. Incidentally, in the last episode, I introduced him as the Associate Professor of Politics and International Studies. I got that wrong. In the university world, this is a lower rank than what Trevor actually has. He's called the Reader of Politics and International Studies. So I accidentally demoted him with my menial knowledge of university lingo. So I apologise for that, Trevor, and I'm glad that I could clear that up. I'll leave his details in the episode description. Links to become a patron and to my social media are in the episode description too. Please do check those out. Thank you for listening. I hope you're okay. Please take care of yourself. And like he says, please keep an eye on this. We can't pretend this isn't happening. We can't pretend this isn't really quite threatening, really quite worrying. I'll be away for just over a week, but when I'm back, we can regroup if you like. Send me your questions and we can discuss when there are undoubtedly more developments. Okay, I'll speak to you in the next one.